I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
On the Empire Podcast this week, we talk to Amy Adams, the star of Night Bitch, she knows how to do it. No, not really.
No.
Okay. Plus, there are rumors that we are talking to Cate Blanchett and Nikki Amuka-Bird, stars of Rumors. And those rumors are not rumors. Those rumors are facts.
You're sticking with the Bee Gees?
I'm sticking with the Bee Gees.
No other band associated with Rumors?
I don't know any band associated with Rumors.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mac. That's a new one on me. Anyway, hello, Pod. I haven't even done the bit where I go, all that plus usual news and nonsense. I've been so discombobulated that I haven't done that bit, but it's fine. No one needs to hear that bit. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Emperor Podcast. This week, we're in the studio once again, joined by my 2 colleagues of such lethal cunning who are overjoyed that I'm back, and I can turn my head to see them after last week.
God.
I have to swivel the chair a little bit.
You're like Christian Bale.
I forgot my tablets this morning, and the pain is coming back a little bit. Woke up last week, couldn't move my head, and then that migrated and mutated to become couldn't move at all. So that was fun. So I had to bail on the podcast in the last second. Luckily, our geek queen, Helen O'Hara, was there to step in to the breach. Mm. And here she is once again.
Hello.
Resplendent in Christmassy green. Hello, Helen.
Yeah, I don't feel like this is a very Christmas green. It's more of like a, I don't know, a jade or something. But anyway.
Hello, Chris. Welcome back.
Hello, James Dyer. Why are you doing sexy voice? It's really disconcerting, not least because it's really working on me. What? Why? Why are you doing low voice?
Is that a microphone in your pocket, Chris?
Why would it be a microphone?
I know his mic technique is bad, but like, I mean, it's not.
Fuck you!
I'm kidding.
Yeah. That's absolutely ridiculous. My microphone technique is bad. How dare you say that? Anyway, let's have a question. This is from Blue Sky. All right, so I've been bleated by someone on B-Sky, and it is, I believe, Gareth Baird, who slid into my DMs. Mm-hmm. It is the season, I don't know if you've noticed this, to be merry. It's also the season to be Pippin, if that floats your boat, but mostly merry.
I plan on being Samwise myself, and just eating a lot of potatoes.
Well, I can't carry that, but I can carry you.
What was the witch king of Angmar doing on Christmas Day?
Why don't you ask him?
I'm going to find out.
You're like his best mate. So this question is from Gareth Baird, who slid into my DMs. Who is the best Christmas villain? My vote is for John Lithgow. Turning it up to 11 in Santa Claus.
Look you just gave me.
We all know what's happening here.
There's only one answer to this question.
There's only one answer.
Let's build up to that answer to this question. And,
all right.
And see if you could possibly task yourself with thinking outside the very, very tiny box that you have.
I have one box.
Think outside the air duct.
Yeah, it's
Think
wrapped
outside.
In wrapping paper. There's a bow, there's tinsel. And it appears to make a noise when you shake it. It says, ho.
There are rules for podcasters, and you must think of a different villain because that's also my answer.
I think John Lithgow in the Santa Claus movie is a very fun, specifically Christmas villain. Like, he's just so OTT.
BJ is his name.
It's
true.
Yep, that's true.
Well, it is Christmas.
Nobody likes a BJ at Christmas.
You were a nightmare at Secret Santa.
Yes, because he did the candy canes.
He did the candy canes, and he was just so sneering and so pantomime and so understood the very specific assignment he was given, which was to just dial it up to a million. You know, I enjoy him as a Christmas film.
He's great. His fate is terrible.
His fate is awful. Yeah, that is pretty harsh.
For people who haven't seen Santa Claus movie, so John Lithgow's BJ is a what? Is a terrible. He's a horrible. Imagine this if you can go with me here. He is a terrible, an evil entrepreneur who wants to get loads of money for himself.
Yeah.
And harm the world.
Yes.
As a result.
Like, he literally fills teddy bears with nails.
Oh my God.
Which you would think would be more expensive than stuffing, but
yeah.
But that's what he does.
They don't let you do that in Build-A-Bear. And so he with the aid of Dudley Moore's elf Patch, who shows him the ways of Christmas, and they have candy canes that when you eat them, make you float into the air.
Yeah, I think they were lollipops, but yes, they basically make you fly.
Well, they're lollipops. I thought they were candy canes, but okay, but that's fine. And they make you fly, and at the end, the authorities are coming for him, and so he decides to eat loads of them so he'll float out of the window of his office and evade the authorities. But here's the thing. He never comes down.
They're not height limited.
No.
He just keeps floating up and up and up
and
into
you don't,
space.
You don't see what happens to him eventually, but it stands to reason that he dies.
He's literally last seen in space.
He died in the cold vacuum of space.
Yeah. Yes, he bumps into Jon Favreau from Deep Impact. they pass each other and go, I loved you in whatever we were in together at exactly the same time. You know what that is? It's it's reverse Hans Gruber, isn't it? So Hans Gruber dies by falling out of a tall building. BJ dies by falling up out of a building.
Wow.
Done. I think we've answered this question, haven't we? John Lithgow and Hans Gruber. There are no other Christmas villains that I can think of.
See, a lot of Christmas villains are either like the protagonist, the Scrooge or the Grinch.
Oh, the Grinch. Don't get me started on that guy.
Or they're kind of, but they're redeemed. So they're not the villain, really, because they're the protagonist. They may not be a hero at the beginning, but they're...
Just misunderstood, isn't that right, Helen? But actually
have a really understandable
agenda that we can all get on board with.
Look, it's Christmas. It's a time for me to break some rules a little bit, all right? But yeah, most of them aren't villains. So it does kind of narrow it down.
Right, okay.
To actually insist on having a villain in your Christmas movie. I mean, and a lot of them in the good Christmas movies don't get enough time because, again, you shouldn't spend that much time on your frickin' villain in most movies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like the rival store owner in The Miracle on 34th Street.
Oh, that prick.
Yeah, I mean, but like, it's Josh Ackland, like, you know, good villain in the 94 version.
Okay.
But, you know, he doesn't have a huge role. You wouldn't say he's an amazing villain for all time. He's just...
Diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, he basically says that and then buggers off again, you know.
But then, you know, you're
Mr.
saying,
Potter, and it's a wonderful life.
I cannot
life.
Believe it took you that long to get to Mr. Potter.
Yeah, sorry. He's the worst. He's pretty bad.
Is he the worst?
He's
though?
One of the worst. He is very bad. I do not like him. I'm willing to be controversial. But I realize this may seem hard to believe, especially, you know, at this time, but there are some business people who don't have the best interests of the populace at heart.
What?
Apparently so. And he is one of those. So just horrible to
contemplate. He takes the money that George Bailey's, is it his uncle?
Yeah.
His befuddled uncle.
His befuddled uncle.
And that causes all of George Bailey's problems because the townsfolk think that George Bailey took the money that his uncle misplaced and Mr. Potter takes the money. And then George Bailey, like, basically thinks about taking his own life. That's all because of...
It's all his fault.
It's all because of Mr. Potter.
Yeah. And in fairness, Uncle Billy's total lack of competence as
Uncle
well.
Uncle Billy should also be killed. I agree.
I don't think I said that.
I agree.
There's a very good bit on it, by the way, in Kid Gorgeous, the John Mulaney stand-up. About
John
Uncle
Mulaney.
Billy, specific.
All right. That's a good one. Jimbo, have you thought outside your little tiny box yet?
The most egregious villain in all of Christmas movies.
And
Andrew Lincoln in Love Actually. Done.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. That's pretty bad.
I think there's a case for a double Rickman. I really do. I really do. I mean, if you ask me, the real Christmas villain is the man who wrote and directed that film.
Oh, come on.
Oh, listen, I've interviewed Richard Curtis many, many times. He's a lovely, lovely man. He's he's very, very smart and rich and successful and all those things. But that movie, no.
It's wonderful and you know it.
Is it?
It has wonderful bits, but is it wonderful?
It is. It is in many ways a wonderful life. That is. If we take out the obvious die-hardiness, which is obviously the best Christmas movie. Love Actually is my favourite Christmas movie.
Is it?
That really is a non-defensible position.
It's wonderful and I love it. And I shall defend it until I die.
I mean, it's a pretty defensible position. A lot of people feel that it's the best Christmas movie. And they're wrong.
I don't think that makes it defensible. I think it just makes it popular.
I don't like that film at all, but I know it intimately because my wife loves it and she insists on watching it every year at Christmas. And I sometimes will leave the room in disgust and then find myself drifting back in and going, oh, I quite like this bit. This is a bit with Hugh Grant. I like this bit.
I'm trying to think the Shane Black Christmas movies. I feel like the villains are not the most memorable bit of those.
Mr. Joshua sticks in your mind, I would say.
Yeah, Mr. Joshua. There's the bad guy in Long Kiss Goodnight's not the best.
No.
The bad guy in Iron Man 3 is, of course, Guy Pearce, Aldrich Killian. But we don't watch... He writes really good bad guys, but you watch those movies for the heroes and the quippies.
That's because he gets the balance right and actually tells stories about his heroes.
He does. But I want to investigate the double Rickmaning.
The Rickmaning is compelling.
What is our Rickman's worth? A lot. So you're going to say Andrew Lincoln, and you're absolutely right. What he does is horrific.
Yeah.
And I've long wanted to know this. And maybe one day we'll get Richard Curtis in to do a retro Love Actually spoiler special interview. Someone else can do that interview, obviously. But I've wanted to know this. What was Andrew Lincoln's plan had Chiwetel Ejiofor opened that door? What was his plan? Oh, hi, mate. How's it going? Not too bad. Good to see you on Christmas Eve. What's that behind your back? A series of cue cards? What are you doing?
You appear to have brought a stereo with you.
You appear to be trying to cuckold me and steal away my child bride.
Yeah. She was, 17 at that time?
She was, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's gloss over that very, very swiftly, shall we? And focus on the Rickmaning. So Alan Rickman, Hans Gruber, falls to his death in Die Hard, but arguably the villain of Love Actually, because what he does to national treasure, Dame
Bastard.
Dame Bastard.
No, he's the bastard. Obviously, she's... Oh, this is confusing.
Dame Bastard Thompson.
She'd probably go with that, you know what?
To give her official title, yeah.
Hey, okay. Fucking hell. Do you think he's... Okay. So, in Love Actually, his character, who is... I believe his name is Malicious Prick, right?
Yeah.
Is taken by the new
Heike
girl
McCatch.
At work.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Heike McCatch.
Okay, right. Heike McCatch, he thinks she's a real catch. And so she comes in and she bats her eyelids at him and she's...
That's more than that, but yes.
Okay, but this is my question. And then he goes out and he's taken with her and there's a...
No, it's a different Liam Neeson movie.
There's a flirtation, right?
Sure, yes.
I don't know what you want. Yes, you do.
There's a flirtation. He goes to... Is it Selfridges that they go to? And Rowan Atkinson.
Wherever the angel Rowan Atkinson works, yes.
Okay, the angel Rowan Atkinson wraps the present for Heike McCatch, and Emma Thompson thinks that he's bought her this lavish thing for her, but it's actually for the lady that he would like. Okay, this is my question. That he would like to have as his bit on the side. And then on Christmas Day, she opens the present and she's heartbroken because instead she's got a Joni Mitchell CD instead of the thing that she saw him buy. And then she realizes that he is potentially seeing someone on the side. Now, here's my question.
And she's also warned him against that particular woman because she knows that she's flirting with him.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, there's a bit at the Christmas party.
Ah, all right. So here's my question. Have they consummated that relationship at that point?
I think no, because she looks pissed off when she answers the door. on the when Hugh Grant's going up and down the street trying to find.
That's right. She's on the same street as Martin.
Everybody
McCutcheon.
Lives on the one street in London. We all, of course, live on the same street.
We actually do live alarmingly close
together in the same house.
Yeah.
But it would still take Hugh Grant an awful long time to get from my house to your house, knocking on every door along the way.
Like it would. Yeah. He would have to. I'm not even going to say the name of the bus. But yeah, he would have to get a bus
and find you dressed as a lobster.
Okay, but enough about Chris's
anyway, James,
after school activities.
You to me are perfect.
Thank you.
she's not without blame.
No, in this scenario.
Without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah. What she does is pretty bad. Like, she's like, oh, I'm just going to go and snog my husband's best friend just once.
She's not snogging him. She kisses him on the cheek.
I don't think it's on the cheek.
She doesn't kiss him on the lips.
Yes, she does. Yeah.
Does he kiss her on the veranda? No, I don't think it's. I don't want to watch this fucking shitty movie again.
Pretty sure though.
Yeah, I think it's a big old lips macaroo.
All right. Okay. Before we get to James, tucked inside his tiny little Christmas box, wanging on about Hans Gruber.
Yeah.
I'm going to suggest my Christmas villain, which is Kevin McAllister.
Yes. You're not maybe unfair. Kevin is a stone cold killer.
He is a psychopath.
I told you I interviewed like doctors and social workers and stuff about that film once and asked them like at what point the wet bandits would be dead. and spoiler guys, the wet bandits would have died several times over.
Oh yeah.
In the course of those traps. So
which Chris Columbus knows.
First of all, most likely just the ice fall down the steps.
Yeah.
The ice fall down the back steps, that probably would have killed them, right? But even if not, when you get hit in the face with an iron falling from a great height that is also switched on.
That's a fractured skull and a singed brow.
You're done. Like, that is it. Goodbye. Hello. Thank you very much.
Have a nice flat top.
Never mind getting hit in the face with a full paint can being swung from a great height.
Or being, like, ignited with a blowtorch.
Can I suggest a crossover? Yeah. What would have happened if the doorbell had rung Christmas Eve at Kevin McAllister's incredibly lavish house that his dad, John Hurd, paid for with drug money that he's been laundering for the Chicago mob.
This
is my theory. There's no fucking way he can afford that house on his salary. Just none. Opens the door Christmas Eve. It's Andrew Lincoln, who has long held a torch for Catherine O'Hara, and he has the "You to Me Are Perfect" sign. He's got the little boombox with Christmas carols on it and all sorts of stuff. Do you think Kevin McAllister would kill him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And there's not a court in the land that would convict.
What about, more obvious ones? Like Black Christmas? What about There's Something in the Barn with the barn elves?
There is.
Yeah, barn elves. They're really, they'll mess you up.
Gremlins. The Gremlins.
Gremlins.
Yeah. Judge Reinhold.
A Krampus as well.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of Krampuses these days. When you get to a certain age, you can't turn your neck. Yeah, good villains all, but I think we know where this is going, Helen. It's been going there since the beginning. It is like Thanos himself.
Inevitable.
Go on, James.
It's Hans Gruber, isn't it? It is Hans Gruber. He is the OG, the gangster. He is the god. He is the Don. He's the greatest cinema villain of all time, isn't he? And I say this with my beloved Thanos, or very much on my Christmas list.
And Darth Vader.
Yeah, true. But Hans Gruber is godly, and it's all Rickman, isn't it? Like everything he does with that character is wonderful. I know it's controversial / tedious to discuss whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie, but for the sake of this discussion, all movies made at Christmas or set out Christmas are Christmas movies, right? So that's where we're landing.
That people even argue that point makes my mind hurt.
I get the point. The point is they're obviously saying like, is it Christmas as a sort of a festive event as opposed to it's just set chronologically at Christmas?
It wouldn't happen if it wasn't set at fucking Christmas, a Christmas movie.
Also, I think it's important that, like as Shane Black says, there is a weirdly hyper-real feel to Christmas and that exists in Die Hard. So I think if you can latch on to that sort of ineffable sort of vibe, then it's a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
And that film does.
Is there an argument to be made that John McClane is the villain of Die Hard?
No.
Right. So all Hans Gruber wants
is an enormous amount of money he hasn't earned.
Yes.
Precisely.
In fairness, we all want that.
We do. I absolutely want that.
Relatable. Yeah.
And he turns up. Listen, if John McClane hadn't been there, Hans Gruber would have just taken the $640 million.
Killed everyone.
Okay,
yes, he would have killed everyone.
But he does straight up murder some people. And that, like, is not good person behavior.
I mean, it would get him a visit from at least one ghost on Christmas Eve to see if he could, they could mend the error of
his
ways.
Look a lot like Mr. Takagi, I think.
Exactly. Like that, because that's a really sympathetic figure. And then you have Hans Gruber.
Yeah. All right. Is Mr. Takagi the villain of Die Hard?
No.
Well, right. I don't know. Is capitalism the villain of Die Hard?
Yeah, is capitalism the villain
also,
of Die Hard?
Also, maybe, but probably no.
All right,
it was
that.
The 80s, after all.
That's true.
I now desperately want to see a Die Hard prequel in which Hans Gruber is visited by the three ghosts of Christmas past, present, and yet to come. That would be absolutely amazing.
You're seeing it like a Blackadder's Christmas special where it basically turns him evil.
Yeah, turns him evil. Oh, that'd be so amazing. Anyway, you can tell I'm back because the opening section has taken about as long as last week's podcast did in its entirety. So we should probably move on. Let's cut our losses. Wish Merry Christmas to all those lovely villains. Hope they repent in time and move on, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So this question this week came from B Sky. It was bleated to me on B Sky. And so where should we go next week? The subreddit?
Sure, yes.
We'll go to the subreddit, yes.
Subreddit. All right. Listen, it's Christmas. We like Christmas questions this time of year. We have two more podcasts left before we knock off for the year. So if you have Christmas questions you want to ask us, the Empire Podcast subreddit is there. It is available. I do check it from time to time. Go on and write down a Christmas question or two or three or four, and we'll see what we can tackle on next week's show. Shall we have a guest?
Let's.
Nikki Amuka-Bird and Cate Blanchett are two of the stars of Rumours, which is not a rumour. It is an actual film that is out this week. It is directed by Guy Madden and Evan Johnson and Galen Johnson, and it is a very, very surreal tale about world leaders who go to the G7 summit. You know the G7 summit, you know, and everyone goes to those things and they have a great time, don't they? And they make terrible decisions. And so this is all about world leaders. They go to the G7 summit, and while they're discussing a treaty in very, very bland politi-speak, the apocalypse happens, essentially, and they get stranded in a forest, and they're assaulted by all kinds of different things, including, but not limited to, a giant brain and 2,000-year-old bog men who like to masturbate onto fires. And so they have to deal with it. And Cate Blanchett plays the Chancellor of Germany, and Nikki Amuka-Bird plays the British Prime Minister. And you got other people in there. You got Charles Dance as the President of the United States of America doing his own accent. This is a very, very surreal film.
Yeah.
A very, very, very surreal film indeed. I had a blast with it. I caught up with Cate Blanchett because we had Cate Blanchett with the budget this week and Nikki Amuka-Bird on Zoom when they were in London. And I wasn't able to go into London because of knick-knack. But anyway, here we go. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Cate Blanchett and Nikki Amuka-Bird, the stars of Rumours. That is actually true. It's not a rumour. They're the stars of Rumours. How's it going?
Well, thank you.
It's great. Nice to be here.
Excellent. Thanks for being here. This is, and I mean this in the best possible way, utterly deranged. What's it like when you are reading a script like this for the first time, and you, I don't know how much you knew about it going in. I don't know how much Guy and the Johnson brothers told you about some of the images that are going to be unfolding on screen, but what's it like reading a script like this for the first time and encountering stuff that I've literally never seen in a movie before?
It's exactly like that. When I read the script, I was saying I didn't really know Guy's work. So as far as I knew, it could have been like a straight drama. And, you know, as you've seen the film, it starts quite conventionally at the G7 and everyone's meeting everybody else. And, you know, there are a few jokes, but it then suddenly genre splices in a way that I've never seen before. Is it going to be a horror? Is there a love affair? Is it a soap opera? By the time we got to the giant brain, literally my mouth was just open. I was just like, what the beep?
You can swear, Nikki, it's fine. It's the Empire Podcast.
Oh yeah, you said that. Yeah. What the heck? Stop.
It's really
what
offensive.
Jesus?
Forget the listeners. I'm finding it really offensive.
But I was also really taken by the ending. Like, I don't know, there's something moving about it to me as well. It just is genuinely like unlike anything I've ever read before.
Kate? Same for you?
Well, I found the whole, I mean, knowing being a huge fan of Guy's work and I'd loved The Green Fog, which she'd done with Evan and Galen. I was expecting, I sort of guessed what the tone would be, but even for them, they're so perverse. They really do, as soon as you think you understand where they're going, they take a U-turn and go somewhere else. And I think it's incredibly deliberate, but deeply perverse. But I think we're so tolerant of the absurdity with which our public figures speak, the sort of the speaking of politics, that when you see it written down, I just laugh out loud. But when we hear it, we sort of accept it. And as you say, Nikki, like when the film starts, you think, well, I understand what this is. I see this all the time. And then once all of the trappings of being a leader go away, the television cameras, because of course leaders have to perform themselves more often than actors do. I mean, it's exhausting for them. And the mobile phone reception, they've got no aides around them. They start to become unmoored from their very identity. And so then they're much more in a Buñuel film. And that's when I think the movie really kicks off into something weird and wonderful.
I read somewhere, and I don't know how true this is because it's all rumors, isn't it? But that guy actually named this after the Fleetwood Mac album, and that he was inspired in some way by the...
Well, exactly. I this is how perverse they are. That I asked them, but all three of them, all members of the thruple, the directing thruple, I said, what does the title mean? Well, I don't know. We just called it Rumours. And I spoke to my husband and he said, oh, of course, it's from the Fleetwood Mac album. You know, when they were all sleeping together and breaking up, but then they made one of the most seminal albums of all time. And so I asked Evan, he said, yeah, maybe. And it was a sense that I got him, you know, like they really do run a mile from meaning. But yes, that's they love that album. And there is, as you said, there's a Mexican soap opera quality to sort of the love affairs that spring up by this unmoored group of politicians.
So what does that mean then? Who is Stevie Nicks? Who is Christine McPhee? And who is... Oh my God! Who's Lindsay Buckingham in this scenario? Have you thought about it in those terms?
Look, we don't want to tell an audience what to think.
You no. tell us.
Yes. That we're running a competition.
That's just keep a stoom for the time being. Kate, I love that word you used. The directing thruple. It's very rare that you get three directors at once. Two directors, yes. All the rage these days. Brothers, friends, cousins, dentists and their patients, they're always, they're working together as duos. But three directors, is that an interesting thing for you to get your heads around? How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, and a functional thruple. I mean, it was really functional. The way they demarcated, just naturally, the way it all fell out is Guy would deal with the sort of the big existential questions, overarching theme questions, and Evan was the one who would probably more often than not, they're all confer, but then he would be, no, you go and talk to her. No, you go and talk to her. And so Evan would come up and give the quote unquote notes. And Galen does a lot of the music and the VFX, but they're all inside it. And they describe it as a writing room. So even though sort of Evan's really behind the text, it's very much the three of them. And there's no, it's quite
very
egoless.
Yeah. And also, it meant from an acting perspective, if you have a question or a query, you need some help, like you always got all the attention that you needed. Quite often with one director, they have like the whole world on their shoulders and every department kind of coming at them at the same time. And it meant that they were very able to take us in and support us. And, I'll feel quite shortchanged when I work with one director.
Yeah.
So from now on, if you're working with one director, you're going, no, I need at least two more.
I need three. I need three.
Was this your first time, Nikki, working with three directors?
It was, yeah. I've worked with two. I've worked with the Wachowski siblings before, and that was also very natural. I think, it's wonderful that they all share this vision. it's such a unique vision that they all share, but they're completely in agreement with what they want to explore together, and that's all that you're after as an actor responding to that.
And Kate, you were aware of Guy's work, of course. I believe that your mutual friend Sparks were almost the connective tissue in a way for this.
Yeah, well, they've done this fantastic song. They've been friends with Guy for a long time, called The Final Derriere, Just, I mean, if you haven't heard it, it's a fantastic song from, I can't remember which one of the movies it was in. But then I did, yeah, all roads were leading to Guy at one point. And then Ari Aster said that he'd written this script with Evan and Galen, and would I be open to talking to him? And I said, of course. So in a way, the work is an excuse to be around people who think in a fascinating way, and Guy absolutely does. I mean, I've been a drooling fan of his work, and what I've loved about it, he really plays with form. And if you're after a Christmas gift, you can go online and purchase his collages. I should take a commission. No, he makes these extraordinary collages, and so film is a way, is playing with images that he cuts up and overlays, and there's so many fascinating, and inexpensive ways that he does so creatively plays with distressed images and the dissolution of the image and the overlaying of image. So film is a natural, it's like another plastic medium for him to play with, and so I just love what he does visually. But then getting him to work on something that's really language and quite story heavy, in a way, was a departure for him. So I was really excited to be part of that journey with him.
Very much so. I love that you are driving people towards buying a Guy Madden Christmas present. But are you on a cut? Do you get a commission?
I will be. don't you worry about that.
Nikki, are you adding
to
your Christmas?
I'm going
to get paid
somehow.
I definitely will.
Nikki, are you going to add it to your Christmas list?
For sure. Yeah. I was saying, it just makes so much sense hearing that that's how he thinks in different art forms, and that's that he's so free to do that on film. I've never seen that before. This like genre mashup. Mm. It feels very brave to me that you would just keep wrong-footing the audience when they think they know what the story is and where this is heading. Just go, no, I feel like we need Enya playing right now, and and that's what you're going to get. I love it.
But what is great is you can't ever, they never have their tongue planted firmly in their cheek.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, you're never quite sure as the audience member. You start to giggle, and you start giggling at the fact that maybe you shouldn't be giggling. It's a really, really unusual tone, and they deliberately avoid being placed in any particular genre or tonal relationship to the audience. And that's really rare. And it's really rare that, sometimes you can set out developing something like that or you're even making it, but then just keep that kind of elusive tone at play, all the way through to when the audience gets to see it. It's really rare.
Indeed. And it was pretty much just over a year ago now that you guys were making this in Hungary.
Oh.
A lot of night shoots in what looked like, I'm guessing, a very, very cold forest in Hungary.
It was multiple forests.
Damp.
Yeah.
We were warm. It was worse for the crew outside. We were
We had easier. Various hot water bottles strapped to different parts of our bodies. Sometimes it was genuinely surreal. Like, we were all delirious. I'd never done that. And Kate was flying home. Like, you had unbelievable stamina throughout the whole thing. But it kind of helped in playing the parts, because we weren't acting. We're like, where are we? What's happening? Just kind of use that for the character.
I was taking my ice baths, so the Hungarian evenings, nights, didn't seem so bad.
That's the secret.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But it was a real joy, and I did feel for Tucker, and when they had to get into the water, that was a bit chilly.
Yes, there was only one night there was.
They knew that when they signed on, right? Yeah.
I've got to let you guys go in a second, but I just want to ask real quick. In a way, this movie, I don't think it's giving too much away to say there's an apocalyptic bent to it, and you've both made apocalyptic movies recently, Don't Look Up and Knock at the Cabin. And I'm wondering if, if you were to do a triple bill of those three movies.
Oh, that's an idea.
Is that a good idea, first of all?
And then you can just turn on the news. If you really want to weep, turn on the news.
We just want a good laugh.
Yeah. Well, order would you watch those movies in if you were to do a triple bill?
I think I'd go Knock at the Cabin first.
I was going to say Knock, then Don't Look Up, and Rumours.
Rumours, yeah.
Do you agree?
Best to last, right? Best to last.
Always end with a giant brain. That's what I say. Yeah. There you go. Kate and Nikki, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to let you go. Merry Christmas to you both. I've got you some Guy Madden artwork as a present. So
yes.
Thanks very much. Take care.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
All right, that was Cate Blanchett and Nikki Amuka-Bird, stars of Rumours. We'll be discussing Rumours later on in the show, in the review section, but now it is time to delve, well, I'll say deep into this week's movie news, but the fact is that we're really going to be in the shallow end, right? Because it was Thanksgiving last week, for which we give thanks, because I got some good deals in the Black Friday sales.
So important.
Which seemed to last all month.
There's the reason for the season.
I got some good shit, so that's all good. But that means that there hasn't been a lot of movie news per se. There wasn't a lot last week, and there is even less, I would argue, this week to get our teeth into. Has anyone been added to the cast of Christopher Nolan's Dracula?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not this week, I don't think. No.
That is so weird.
We'll have like two next week, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We've had a couple of, I hesitate to call them presents. We've had a couple of bits of coal in the stocking, I would say, this week in the form of two video treats. One was a threat, would appear to be coming from Sony. It didn't come with a ransom note, but it was the first 8 minutes of Craven Nanta. So, you know, don't mess about with that.
I haven't actually watched
that. No, God,
yet.
Neither did I.
Did they say we will release the rest of the movie unless our demands are met?
Basically, yes. This is a warning. Yeah, so that was fun. I did not watch it. Because for spoiler reasons, I don't want to spoil the majesty of this film. I do not want to see those 8 minutes out of the designed context. Because I feel it would lessen...
Conchutex.
Oh my God, I'm so proud of Helen. This is incredible.
It would lessen their impact. So I didn't watch it.
Sure. What's the tagline, the amazing tagline? I think it was for Suspiria. And the amazing tagline for Suspiria is, the only thing more terrifying than the first 90 minutes of this movie are the last...
Fine.
No, it's the other way around. It's the other way around. The only thing more terrifying in the last 20 minutes of this movie are the first 90, which is like, well, why should I go to see it then? I should just walk out after 90 minutes. But they could do that with Craven the Hunter. Like, the only thing more terrifying than the first 8 minutes of this movie
is the rest of it.
Yeah.
Because it is two hours and 7 minutes long. So,
we are going. We're having a group outing.
We are. All three of us.
Next week.
I'm not, sadly. I can't.
No, that's true, yes.
He's bailed. Doesn't have the stomach for it.
Every day is Christmas Eve.
I mean,
every day, Chris.
Every single day.
You've got to keep the spirit of Christmas Eve inside your heart.
I know, but you have that one relative who really doesn't know what you do and really doesn't know what you like and then buys you something horrific.
Socks.
Yeah. Socks.
Yeah.
I like socks. Socks are nice.
Craven
like
socks.
Maybe
Craven
not
the
socks.
Hunter socks. Listen, it could be good.
It could be great.
It could be good.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, what other trailer was there this week?
Other delectable treats in the video medium were the trailer for Snow White, the upcoming live-action, in heavy inverted commas, remake of classic Disney animation Snow White.
Hi-ho!
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I like that they're trying to make her more of like a freedom fighter or something. Like, she's leading a rebellion against the queen, who isn't being very nice.
Kind of. She's not exactly a partisan, is she?
No, but I think that's what they're going for. Mm. It seems to be.
This is the live-action remake of Snow White, directed by Mark Webb.
Mm-hmm.
From the Amazing Spider-Man films, so you know it's good. And then it's starring Rachel Segler as Snow White.
Who we like.
And Gal Gadot. And that all looks fine. All looks okay. You know, as you would expect. This, of course, it's the first Disney film, right? Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The first
feature, yeah.
First feature film. 1939. 1979. 1937. 1939. It's a beloved historic epic, and it all looks okay. Then the dwarves turn up. Terrifying nightmare fuel. Because they're CG, right? The dwarves in this are CG.
They
don't look finished.
And maybe they aren't. And there's three months to go. And so, you know, we didn't love Paddington in the trailers for the first film. Maybe the dwarves will be delightful.
Maybe.
In the finished film. But this isn't super promising. I don't know.
No,
I just like the way they were designed originally was to make use of squash and stretch in animation and show off what, you know, Disney Studios could do. And there was a reason for the way they looked. They were meant to be cartoony. And now you have this weird hybrid cartoony form that's also meant to look live action and stand next to a real person. And it is weird. You'd almost want them to go like a full-on Who Framed Roger Rabbit route with this.
I honestly think you would. I think leaning into the cartoony aspect of it in a slightly less uncanny valley way would have been the way to go.
Yeah, maybe.
Because there's a slight shiver down the spine seeing these particular ones. Speaking of things that are terrifying, the song, the new musical numbers. And so we get a glimpse. Can you say glimpse of something you hear? Probably not. A soundbite, an earworm, a sampling, a sous-son of the new song.
Well, I feel like you're not going to like cast Rachel Zegler and only use her for like one song, two songs in the original.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, it's not as naked an Oscar grab as usual, I feel. It is obviously an Oscar grab.
But it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit
because it's
a modern song. Disney songs, I'm not an expert on it, like the Dean of Disneyversity, Mr. Ben Travis. But the Disney song has evolved so much over the years. And the songs that are in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs are they're short.
Mm-hmm.
And they're stylistically very, very different from pretty much anything that you get in the Disney film the last 20, 25 years. And this song, which is a modern song, which you know, I don't know what it's called, but it has modern production style.
Waiting on a Wish.
Okay.
It
doesn't fit with
maybe
the way you work or any of that stuff.
Maybe they'll have zhuzhed those.
Maybe.
And also,
they
like, with the way you
they'll
work.
They've extended them at the very least, yeah, won't they?
And those are also like working songs. They're not, you know. Yeah. Whereas, obviously, this one, and they've actually said that Waiting on a Wish is the I Wish song that you get in a lot of the Disney movies. So, you know, like The Little Mermaid, perfect example, or, you know, Belle wanting to get out of her dead end town, perfect example.
You said Belle End.
Apologies. I mean, I said the two words.
They were quite far apart.
Span of a sentence,
I heard Bell End.
Yeah, well.
Every time you open your mouth, I hear Bell End as well.
But anyway, this is the I Wish song, which is very much a feature of the modern Disney movie.
Yes.
In a way that it may
and musicals, in
and,
fact.
And, musicals,
they, and they
yeah.
didn't have them back in the day because
Not really, no.
they basically...
Didn't wish for anything.
They didn't wish for anything,
It was
yeah.
the Depression. You know, what was the point?
Yeah, what was the point?
I wish to survive a little bit longer.
Listen, every day is Christmas Eve here, but we've started off with two lumps of coal. You're absolutely right, Jimbo.
Yeah.
So is there anything that will bring us Christmassy joy?
Doug Liman is making a supernatural thriller / horror with Tom Cruise called Deeper.
Oh.
Yeah, that's fine. We don't know much about it, but
great.
You know, they both seem up for it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Up for it, man for it.
Up for it, man for it. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully they previously collaborated, of course, on Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
And American Made.
Yes, I was about to say the one about the plane. So
the
thank you for
plane.
Remembering the
name. The plane.
And that's all the news I've got. Disney's Moana,
that's
number
it.
Two, made some money.
It did make all the money.
All of the money. At $386 million opening weekend worldwide, which I think is the best of Well, best Thanksgiving weekend ever.
Best animated opening ever, apparently.
But that's wild, isn't it? Because, and again, I have not seen Moana 2, though I'm a big fan of the first Moana, but the general consensus has been that it is a kind of a less appealing cover version, essentially, of the first film. That seems to be the general consensus. So it's surprising that it's been such a runaway hit.
Well, I personally think the first film is a 5-star film, and this one's a strong 4.
Okay, so you're saying it's still really good, but just not like
exactly, yeah.
Transcendental.
Yeah. So I'm very pleased to see it doing well. It's interesting year at the box office. I was having a look at the top sort of 20 the other day globally, and it is a bad time out there to not be a sequel. It is a very bad time to not be a sequel.
It's IP apocalypse at the moment, isn't it?
It really is. And you know, obviously the message that Hollywood is taking from that is more sequels.
Yeah.
And I think what they should be looking at instead is maybe return on investment, because these are getting massive, massive budgets for a start. But also, I think they should be looking at the overall box office is down. People are turning away in general, and that should be worrying people more than maybe it is. Having said
that, but then every now and again, something like this hits, and you have the perfect storm at the moment of Wicked, which isn't a sequel; it's a prequel. Although it is a sequel to All the Great
quell.
And Powerful.
It's a quell. So
it's a quell.
Yeah,
it's a side quell.
It's a side quell.
Whatever the hell it is.
It's a retcon well.
But that Wicked opening, Moana 2 opening, and then even Gladiator 2 is getting something of a tailwind from those as well, and is holding its own pretty well as an R-rated movie that appeals to
men and women who like thighs.
Who doesn't love thighs?
Thighs are great.
Yeah.
But yeah, So what do you think is the highest placed non-sequel / prequel at the worldwide box office this year, without looking at it? I'll give you a clue. It's at something like 19.
Really?
Yeah.
So hang on.
Assuming we call Wicked a prequel.
Oh my God, you're right. It's wow, I've just looked it up.
I told you not to look it up.
I know, I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's 15.
Okay. So it was 15 at the worldwide box office?
Yeah.
Well, this year, non-prequel, non-sequel,
non-IP. So that's ruling out something like The Fall Guy.
It's not IP.
Is it If?
No, but that is the highest placed totally original film.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that...
I'm very confused by this question.
It's down at 22.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is adapted from a book,
so
if that helps.
There's source material. It's just not a sequel.
No, I'm gone. What is it?
It is It Ends With Us.
Yeah.
It ends with us.
So basically, the second highest grossing film of the year is Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yeah.
The highest grossing non-sequel is It Ends With Us. And the highest grossing original film of the year is If. So it's a really good year to be Ryan Reynolds or Blake Lively.
Yeah.
Or a member of that household.
What about The Wild Robot? Yeah.
The Wild Robot is based on a book.
Oh, is it? I didn't realize that.
What about Deadpool and Wolverine?
That is neither based on something nor a sequel, of course.
Yeah, brand new, original.
Original idea.
Non-IP.
That is absolutely insane. It really is sequel mania.
And of course, Helen's right, that rather than going, hey, Inside Out 2 did really, really well this year, obviously the biggest film of the year so far, there's a chance Moana 2 might overtake
it
especially
like
with the Thanksgiving-ness, possibly.
It's a bigger opening.
It had a bigger opening.
But it's all but $1.7 billion. That's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. Moana 2 would have to really, really go for it. I think it'll still be Inside Out 2 at the end of the day.
Do you?
And the studios will look at this and go, oh, well, clearly people want more sequels, rather than going, well, hang on, these are sequels to movies that were absolutely original in their time. Why don't we make more of those? And then maybe people will, attach themselves to those emotionally, and then we can make sequels to those down the line. So get the balance right. But you can also see why Disney, in this case, would do that, because last year they did bring out an original movie, Wish. It tanked.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've gone, quick, what do we do? Let's turn the Moana TV show into Moana 2. And the bean counters will now go, we were absolutely justified in doing so. The movie also turned out to be pretty good, a much better than Wish.
But this is the problem, isn't it? It's execution. And as somebody was saying on Blue Sky, I think this week.
Oh, Blue Sky.
You know, you don't get a breakout like Terrifier 3 unless you actually made Terrifier in the first place. You know, you don't get Deadpool and Wolverine unless you bothered making Deadpool. You don't get Moana 2 unless you actually made Moana. And same with Inside Out. Like, you do have to have original films in the first place. Yeah. And they are bending over backwards to try to avoid that simple truth.
Yeah. No, but you're absolutely right, though, isn't it? Because it's like they'll come up with original ideas and maybe only a small percentage of them will actually hit. And when they do hit, they will then flog that new IP to death because it hit. But you're right. They need to dedicate us. You can't just think about like year two. You've got to think about year three, year four, year five. Where are your new IPs? Where are your new ideas? Where are your new sequels going to come from? What are they going to be sequels to? This is all good stuff.
I mean, so many of the films that I really, really liked this year were original movies, Long Legs, and other films.
Other films are available.
Other films are available.
Yeah, let me have a look. My top list of the year, top 10 of the year, well...
Conclave, right? Conclave is
on my top 10.
It is a sequel to The Pope Must Die.
That's true, it is. It genuinely
is. There is genuinely only one sequel on my list this year. And I feel like, James, you can instantly guess which one it
100%,
is.
But it wasn't high enough on your list. And that's why we're no longer friends.
Wow. Was number two.
That's
James.
What I'm saying. It wasn't high enough on your list.
My top 10 of the year is going to change a lot because I've missed a lot of stuff and I'm catching up with things over the next 2 weeks. We're recording our Review of the Year podcast on the 17th of December, by which point we think we'll have seen all the stuff that we need to see.
I've already seen Dune.
James has already seen Dune, but my top 10, I'm not going to give it away. We'll talk about our individual top 10s when we get to that. But I'm looking at my top 10 of the year as it is right now. And there are 5 original films on there that are not based on... Okay. There's 4 original films that are not based on IP. There is a 5th that is a book adaptation, and that's American Fiction. And yes, it did. It is a film that came out in the UK this year.
True,
and
it
was technically last year.
Oh, if we're talking book adaptations, then 4 of my remaining ones are definitely book adaptations. And one was based on an article.
On an article. Mm. All right. Okay. Well, there we go. Sienna Miller has joined the cast of the Jack Ryan movie.
Yes.
Jack Ryan movie?
Yes.
You know about this? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
John Krasinski's Jack Ryan is busting out of the serial format and getting a Prime movie.
You know, now that he is the sexiest man alive.
Yeah.
Not Jack Ryan.
Sexy Jack Ryan.
Well, John Krasinski.
I mean, I'll be honest, like, look at Jack Ryan's history. Jack Ryan's case to be the sexiest man alive is...
All right.
Pretty strong.
Who's the sexiest Jack Ryan? Last time we did this, we talked about the best Jack Ryan, but this is a much more important question. Who is the sexiest Jack Ryan? And you have to consider them only as Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
Not any of their extracurricular.
No, because there's obviously a very, very clear winner here if we're saying who's the sexiest Jack Ryan, and it is, of course, Harrison fucking Ford.
Yes.
But as Jack Ryan...
Only as Jack Ryan.
Alec Baldwin.
I know. And like young Alec Baldwin, you remember in 30 Rock where at one point they see a picture of young Jack and are basically like, oh, damn. So, that's a compelling
case. He's a contender.
Young Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford, middle-aged.
Middle Harrison Ford is good.
Yeah.
Then it's Ben Affleck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then it is...
Chris Pine.
Then it is the current holder of People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive Award and holder of my favorite Interview of the Year Award for If, the year's most successful original non-IP movie, John Krasinski. Who is the sexiest of those 5 Jack Ryans? If we had to have a jack-off, who would come out on top?
Wow.
No. Oh,
so many
poorly chosen words.
What are you talking about?
I feel like the safe and easy answer, middle age or not, is Harrison Ford.
You think?
Yes. You think?
Yes.
Well, I suppose, what are you wanting from your Jack Ryan?
We've talked about this before. They are all Gary Stews, right? They have essentially no flaws.
Jack Ryan has a flaw.
What is his flaw?
He's a bit shit.
Is he, though?
He has to be bailed out in Clear and Present Danger constantly by Willem Dafoe.
Well, okay, but that's because Willem Dafoe is a trained SEAL operative or similar. And Jack Ryan is meant to be a desk analyst and still manages to kill a bunch of dudes.
I could analyze a desk.
And get out of difficult situations, at which point, like, would be super dead.
Well, he's the most, I think Krasinski's Jack Ryan feels to me like the most field operative-y.
He does, definitely.
He rolls up his sleeve, he gets his hands dirty, he rocks a beard.
He's a very sexy Jack Ryan, and I approve entirely of his beard.
I'm leaning towards Krasinski as sexy Jack Ryan.
Do you not think Ben Affleck is the sum of all flaws? No?
I do know. He's a good Jack Ryan. That's a really good film as well. So
underrated.
Yeah. Okay. I have to say, and I don't get me wrong, like I wouldn't kick Chris Pine out of bed, but I would say he's not winning this particular race because I don't think that and this is no, you know, comment on Chris Pine's sexuality, sexiness, sexosity.
He's a sexy guy.
He's not the best Jack Ryan, and his Jack Ryan isn't the sexiest Jack Ryan.
Yeah. I think Krasinski might be the sexiest Jack Ryan.
All right, we're going to have to do a...
But then there's Baldwin again, like...
All right, we're going to do a Jack Ryan, I'm saying this very carefully, sexy ranking.
Right.
Ranking. Okay, we're going to rank Jack Ryan sexiness.
Okay.
All right, okay, definitive. Number 5. Okay, so that's least sexy. Who are you saying? I'm saying Chris Pine. Number 5.
I think, not the actor Chris Pine.
No, I've been in a lift with Chris Pine.
The Jack Ryan.
Wowzers.
Yeah. Chris Pine. Bottom of the list, rank him off.
Oh, no. I might have to agree, even though it goes against every fibre of my being.
It pines
me to put Chris Pine at the bottom of any list of sexy things.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't feel right.
Helen,
like
there is a place beyond the pine. It's fine.
If we were ranking the sexy Hollywood Chrises.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. He'd be number 2, 1, maybe 2.
But again, it depends. Like, again,
can you tell there's no movie news?
As Captain Kirk, super, super sexy, but when he rocks his stripy beard,
even better.
The stripy beard does take him to another level. It's true. Yeah.
We'll leave the Hollywood Chrises another time.
Okay.
So good.
We're still ranking the Jacks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is so dangerous.
This is very dangerous. Okay, number 4 then.
5 is Pine.
Yeah.
Affleck for me.
You think?
Yeah.
I'd have gone Baldwin.
Oh no. Get out of town.
Young Baldwin?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. No.
Especially
Young Baldwin can never be below 3, which is where I'm putting him.
Yeah. Young Baldwin on a submarine, long, hard, full of semen. I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, he gets great knitwear in that film. I'm not even kidding.
Knitwear or nipwear?
Knitwear.
A head that good is never getting knits, by the way. All right, so number 4 is Affleck. I honestly don't remember him. I don't remember him being sexy in The Sum of All Fears.
Really?
I don't remember it. Number 3?
Is Baldwin.
I'm not having that.
Have you watched The Krasinski Show?
No.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have.
Yeah, as have I.
And he is very sexy in that show. So.
All right, okay, democracy wins.
Having said that, Krasinski number 2 and Harrison Ford number 1, because come on, it's still fucking Harrison Ford.
No, correct.
You've got to divorce him from the wider Harrison Fordiness.
I am.
And focus specifically on the Jack Ryan-iness.
Yeah, but here's the thing, he still has Harrison Ford's face.
He still has the finger. He points
and the finger. And
does,
the voice.
He does. He does
he's got a good voice.
But he's just a man in a suit with a side parting.
Asking you to love
him. All the more attainable-ish.
Oh, I see where you're coming at here, Helen.
Steady.
I see. This Helen, she's got the signs on Jack Ryan. She wants to oust Ann Archer as his wife in that. I see what you're doing.
No, but that's part of the appeal, is that you couldn't. Because he would be loyal. Oh, my God.
She's got me.
Even
he's
dreamier.
Even sexier now. He wouldn't turn up at a doorstep on Christmas Eve with a fucking boombox and some cue card saying, you to me are perfect. He wouldn't do that.
He'd be too busy trying to get the printer to work.
Yeah. How dare you, printer, is what he would say. All right. Well, that's it for movie news.
Wow.
Oh, what is wrong?
Shall we have another guest?
Please.
Okay. Ah, let's have Amy Adams, shall we?
Hooray.
Amy Adams. We love Amy Adams. She is amazing. And she is the star of Marielle Heller's Night Bitch, which opens this week, in which she plays a suburban housewife, a mother, who feels that she might be turning into a dog.
We've all been there.
We've all been there. We sent along our very own Alex Godfrey. We didn't send him along. I think they talked in Zoom. But you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
He talked to her on Zoom. So here's Alex Godfrey talking to Amy Adams on Zoom. I wonder if he asked her who she thought was the sexiest Jack Ryan. Fingers crossed. Enjoy.
Hi, Amy Adams. Welcome to the Empire.
Hello.
Hello. It's such a wonderful film, and the people I know who went to the premiere were really taken by it as well. I saw it a few months ago. We've done a couple of pieces in the magazine. I spoke to Marielle, and one of my writers spoke to you and her.
Yeah.
It's great to be talking to you again. It's, I should say for people who haven't seen it, which is most people listening to this, Night Bitch is about a mother played by you, whose career, I would say, falls by the wayside as she has a kid. And it's about her struggle to sort of reconcile, you know, her situation. And I guess it's about compromise and sacrifice and her trying to navigate all that without losing her mind. But I think that's only because pretty much that's what actually does happen. It's hard not to. I'm not a mother, but I am a father. I relate to a lot of this film. Actually, I related to your character and your husband's character in different ways.
Yeah.
Which I think is fantastic. And do you know, it's interesting. We don't usually ask personal questions on Empire. You know, we keep to the work and we keep to the films. But I feel like it's hard not to in this film because of what it's exploring and the fact that you produced it, and it's clearly personal for you. I mean, would you say it's your most personal film?
Yeah, I think there are aspects of it that are extremely personal and like sort of tapping into sort of unspoken insecurities that I have or unspoken conflicts that I've had. Also in the reflection of the relationship, my husband and I laughed a lot watching this because there's so much that we identify with. And when I read the book, that's very much a huge part of why I thought this could be so beautiful, is there was something not only in the experience of sort of the internal conversation that mother is having with herself, which is at one time critical of herself and another time, you know, really having sort of a harsh eye on others. Like there was something that just felt really relatable, but it was also so much about the relationship that she has with her husband and with her son, and these deep conflicting, this deep conflicting dialogue that she has with herself. That felt very relatable to me, you know. When I read the book and we were talking about what director we wanted to do it, Mari was my very first choice. And they were like, I don't know, she just had a baby. She's not reading anything. And I was like, whoop, I think she should definitely read this. And she identified so deeply and put so much of her personal experience. Like she was writing this while she had her child down for a nap, her baby down for a nap. So, and another baby stuck in front of the television. So she talks about this. And so she really is putting so much of herself into this. And we had several conversations just about how much we related to one another in our experience and how much we related to the character. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there. And not just with mothering, but like the ideas of identity and the idea of feeling invisible at times. And yeah, there's much of it. Yeah.
Did you, when you read the book, because the whole project came from you, right? You read it and set it all up. Is that right?
Well, I was a part of a team that did that. Sue Nagel at Annapurna brought the book to me. They had gotten the rights She read the book and brought it to me, and we decided to develop it together. So yeah, I was there at the very beginning.
So when you read it, were there loads of points where you're going, yep, yep, that I know what that feels like. That's, yeah, that's me. That this is, was it like that? Was it just bing, bing, bing?
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff inside of the book. A lot of stuff about, like, even the stuff as it relates to her own mother. You know, this idea of sort of generational maternal experiences that are passed down, and that it sometimes benefit us and sometimes create a lot of conflict within us about how we move through the world as mothers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also, I spoke to Murray about how, you know, as a woman, how your body changes, but also about your
but also. I mean, there was that. I definitely identify with that. Yeah.
Right. Did you feel like that you definitely, as you were, you know, raising a young kid, and did you feel like feral sometimes? Did you, because the metaphor is, you know, it's a big metaphor, and obviously there's the fun part of the film and the title and everything, but there's something very true and real and genuinely biological about it as well.
Absolutely. I think from the moment, I mean, everybody has a different birth experience, but for me, I was able to do a natural childbirth. So like, I felt extremely feral, you know, at that. I think that is one of that. I was extremely feral in that moment, just like hunching around the hospital room, like grunting and yelling. And, you know, it's just such a lack of, I never felt out of control. I felt actually very in control. I just never felt, there was no third eye or of judgment of my behavior. It was just so connected with my body. And it was a trip.
It's interesting, isn't it, actually? Because, you know, I was in the room for my daughter's birth. And so, you know, I witnessed all this firsthand. Yeah. And I guess that's, you know, one of the only times where you can really go full, where you go full primal, and it's fine, and you have no choice. And you just, you let rip, right?
I'm so curious about it now from your perspective. Like, I'm just, my husband has talked about it a little bit, but I think it was, he was a really wonderful sort of, birth partner, you know, so I was lucky. He gave me a lot of space to be, you know, to swear and yell and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean. It's like everything's allowed in that situation. You can be a crazy person, right? But I guess that's what the film's about, because it's the normal craziness. It's this, what's inside of us.
Yeah, and it's sort of this transformation that happens in parenthood, where you're suddenly responsible for protecting a life, that changes you, you know? And I know it changes it for men as well, but for women, there's such a deep, like, hormonal relationship that happens through the process of giving birth and after. Like, there's not a lot of conversations about what happens hormonally directly after having your child, you know?
Yeah.
And that to me was, Mari and I talked a lot about that, and I had sisters, so I was able to, you know, reach out to a community to get some understanding. And I think the book and the film talk so much about the importance of community, and it's so true. It's a very, necessary part of going through the experience of becoming a parent, like just having other people to talk to find out if it's normal, you know, to get a sense of how other people are feeling. And it can be very isolating, because you're so, you know, tucked in with this little one, taking care of its needs, learning how to adjust your life to their needs. And
well, that's really interesting in the film as well, because you are part of a community, but, you know, you're part of this group of women, but sometimes feeling completely on the outside of it as well.
Yeah, I think she's, you know, mother in particular, is sort of in between two places, right? She's not who she was, but she hasn't figured out who she's going to be.
Yeah.
So she's in this extremely confusing and discombobulating time. And I think that's what makes her so vulnerable, you know, and she's like stuck alone with her own thoughts, which are racing and moving in so many different directions. And I think that's where the idea of, you know, the transformation and metamorphosis in the book starts to take root is, Mari talks about it, like when she does have these ideas that she might be, something's happening, something strange is happening, whether it's the fur or her teeth. And it's not a scary thing. I think when she finally has the realization of what might be happening, it's almost like, oh, phew, now it all makes sense. Now I understand why I've been feeling. So there's an exhilarating power in it that she finally has an explanation and a way through this time and this particular experience she's going through.
Let's talk about the metamorphosis. I mean, you touched briefly on it in the interviews you did for our feature for the magazine.
Yeah.
You talked about what you called BDE, big dog energy, right?
Yeah.
Trying to get the right amount of dog. Trying to do that in a way that felt right and felt natural. And from what I gather, you workshopped the growls and the barks with Murray. Were you barking around? Were you on all fours? What was it like?
I didn't do the bark and the crawl at the same time. Well, I did have to workshop the crawl a little bit too, or the run, because there was a very specific physicality they were looking for in the sort of like when she collapses and hunches and finally like gives into the beast. But no, I would bark for Mari because I knew that I would have to bark in the film. So she wanted to make sure, rightfully so, she was assuming my bark would be high pitched, which it was. So I had to work on lowering my bark.
Will you have the end result?
What you see in the film is my barking at the table. We call it the kale salad scene. So
were you practicing that on your own at home as well, knowing that you would have to be doing it for Mari?
I'm definitely a girl who practices. Yeah. I don't like to show up without a really like a couple valid offers, you know. But also, you know, Mari and I talked about not only like the bigger transformation things, but like implementing, you know, small little indications of her feral self coming through until it starts to grow into this more this of course more obvious transformation. We talked a lot about that, about how she starts to feel more powerful in her body, more centered in her body, and like less judgmental of her body, and just understanding that it's just a vehicle of feral, maternal, ancestral energy, you know, and like really like a radical acceptance of all of the surreal, grotesque aspects of her body, you know.
Wonderfully grotesque. Mari said a really interesting thing to me. She was talking about the fact that she thinks this film is really about rage, you know, based on conversations she was having with her girlfriends, raising kids, and I guess with you as well. And she said for her, the metaphor of Night Bitch is like this unchecked rage. And that by sort of coming to terms with that and integrating Night Bitch into yourself, you can sort of accept that and get through that and then let go of Night Bitch, so you don't have to be like that so much anymore. Is that how you feel? Is that how you felt? And I wondered if going through that process of exploring this for the film helped you to think about your own life in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely that internalized rage, but on top of that, like shame and regret and sadness, there's so much that piles on that creates that rage. rage is the expression of all the unchecked other emotions that you've been bottling up until really there's nowhere else for them to go. So when I think of rage, I think of it as just encapsulating so many other, so many times we've stuffed emotion down. That's why I love the kale salad scene. It's just everything being shoved down until it just explodes. And I definitely identify with that. And I think that in the manifestation of Nightbitch, it just gives her somewhere to put it and feel freedom in the rage as opposed to sitting on it and it creating like depression, you know, unexpressed rage with her. And I think that can create a deep depression when you're not acknowledging the truth of the experience that you're feeling, experience of your emotions and your frustration, all that good stuff.
Would you say this film has been helpful on that level? Because it does sound like there's, I mean, maybe therapeutic is the wrong word, but certainly when you're with a film like this, when you're exploring such relatable material and material that has, you know, affected you and is still affecting you, that you come out of the other side of it with, I mean, have you come out of the other side with revelations and conclusions about things that you didn't have before making it?
Yeah, I think there was some catharsis in it, and there was a deep understanding about connection to community. For me, that was a big one. And also for like healthy, honest communication, you know, not fighting, but just really speaking calmly with others about what I might be feeling in any given moment instead of sitting on it and then being a powder keg, which is my typical handling of things.
Is it?
Oh, I'm definitely someone, because I want to practice patience at all times. You know, that's kind of one of my great goals in life is to increase patience and tolerance and
acceptance. I mean, it's still a goal. I wouldn't say that I'm quite there yet.
Are you an exploder? Like, are you sort of sit on it, explode, or are you like a steam vent?
I think a bit of both. You know, you try and improve yourself. I definitely am an exploder, but I don't like to be. And whenever it does happen, I feel bad about it.
I feel horrible. It's the worst thing ever, isn't it?
Yeah, because you feel like an idiot and you feel like you should be better than that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do it often, but like at 50, I'm like, I should have a better handle on emotional regulation than this, you know?
You would think, but it happens. And I think the problem is there are external forces that you can't control. And as much as you might have a plan and self-improvement in mind, shit's going to happen a million times during the day that's going to get in the way of you being the person you want to be, right?
Yeah. Mine's usually very much in relationship to Nightbitch, where I'll just sit on things for so long. And then the smallest thing, it's that idea of the straw that broke the camel's back. I'm totally that person.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often, to be clear. I'm not going to explode on you all of a sudden. Can you imagine just all of a sudden I'm just like, that's enough.
That would be a dramatic but wonderful end to our interview. And if you want.
No. There's no reason.
It's okay. Okay. Well, let's wrap up. It's nice to not have an explosive ending, I guess.
Yeah. I'm really grateful that I had the opportunity to do this film. And there is a cathartic element of it where doing the film required me to have radical acceptance of myself while doing the film and not be judgmental and not really think about an outside perspective. And I think that's been really helpful for me. I've become a lot more self-accepting since doing the film. That's been wonderful. Yeah, it's been a wonderful.
That's a good result, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
I can't imagine that happens on every film.
No. Sometimes I come off a film with a very different, but this character, really, her experience is about self-acceptance, right? So
yeah.
I think getting to transfer that for myself is It's a real gift.
Good. And I think people watching film will get a lot from it as well on that level. So let's finish there. Thank you so much. It was wonderful to talk to you. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Amy.
Yeah, great to talk to you too.
All right. Have a good time.
Okay. Bye.
All right. That was Amy Adams, star of Night Bitch. We'll be talking about that in just a few seconds, for it is time for the reviews section of the show, talking about the films that are out this week on the Multiplex and indeed on your Sofaplex as well. Before we do, I want to give a very, very quick shout out to All We Imagine as Light, which I had seen and thought was terrific. Payal Kapadia's movie about three nurses in Mumbai. I was going to talk about it in last week's show. Hopefully you can still see it in cinemas around the country. It's really, really great. We gave it 4 stars, so do check that movie out. But in terms of stuff that's out this week, Hell's Bells, we had Cate Blanchett and Nikki Amuka-Bird from Rumours on the show earlier on. Shall we start with Rumours?
Yeah,
sure. Let's start with Rumours.
So this starts with your, you know, classic kind of G7 summit, all the leaders posing together for a picture, walking off into the woods, having their little sort of, you know, sub chats as they go, still surrounded by photographers, aides, flunkies in general. And then they're left in a gazebo to eat lunch and start working privately on this draft statement that they're all going to put out in response to a vague crisis that the world is facing that we're not really told anything about. And then things start to get a little bit weird. So it basically becomes clear that they've been abandoned. There is no one else around suddenly. They had previously been shown off this kind of bog body that was being excavated nearby, and now the bog bodies start coming to life. There is, yes, a bit with a giant brain in a forest. Yeah. There is some very surreal, trippy kind of stuff going on. Everyone has the hots for the Prime Minister of Canada, which I think is very relatable and understandable.
Sexiest Jack Ryan.
Yeah, he's pretty hot. And then it's just a really weird, deeply strange film. And it kind of has these moments, and it does come back and forth to these moments of sort of political satire. But it also then goes off into completely strange, not terribly satirical, just absurd situations and absurd moments of comedy that I don't think are making, or at least to me, aren't making any particularly pointed political statement. They're just absurdist. So it's a weird film. I wasn't bored, but I also wasn't always sure what was going on in the sense of, like, something can be absurd, but you still know what the point of it is.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like that was necessarily always the case here. But I'm not sure it was meant to be, as I say.
No, I don't think it's a movie to be understood in that way.
But I maybe wanted it to be something that it didn't want to be, which is a bit sharper and a bit more sort of almost Death of Stalin-y, it isn't that at all.
100%, and that's where I fell as well, because I think Iannucci does this kind of satire incredibly well, and it's very well written. This, I mean, to be fair, it's not entirely satire. It's part satire, part folk horror, part sort of surrealist black comedy, and then also part soap opera at times, just with the dialogue and the way that it's shot. And it is, as you say, deeply weird. And all the way through this, all I could think is, there are such good people in this. Alicia Vikander turns up speaking Swedish exclusively. There's a brain the size of a hatchback. You know, Cate Blanchett's in there being Angela Merkel. I mean, there's so many strange things that you can fit in sentences there. I don't even know where to start with them. And they must have seen something in this to want to be part of it. I do not see what they saw, because, you know, lots of reviewers have liked this, and there's still a part of me that just, am I just too stupid? Am I too stupid to understand the genius at work here? Because to me, this film was deeply absurd and weird. But for me, like, that's not enough. Like, you can be absurd and weird if you have a really good story or you're doing something really interesting with it. And I felt like this was weirdness for weirdness's sake. And they have, like, zombie bog men wanking into a fire, exactly as you say. There's a pedo-hunting AI in it because reasons. And all the way through, I was like, it's just weirdness on top of weirdness on top of weirdness. I don't really, really know what's going on. I'm not sure I care to know what's going on. I wasn't bored. You're absolutely right. But I was quite irritated all the way through it. I really, really profoundly, on an almost soul-deep level, did not enjoy this film at all. And its existence bothers me. The fact that this exists in the world offends me slightly.
I'm so glad I didn't give you the interview.
But a lot of people have really enjoyed it. And there's even a part of me that did you though? Did you really? I don't believe you. But clearly they did, and it is just me. But
I did.
I don't get it. I don't understand it. I am too stupid.
I don't think it is. I think it's a movie that I think, you know, Guy Madden is a filmmaker who likes to think outside the box, not the same box that you have. A box
there is
that,
no box.
The only thing in James's box is a single copy of Die Hard. Yeah. That's,
and a copy of Dune on Blu-ray.
And a copy of Aliens. There are three things in James's box.
What's in the box?
Guy
well,
Madden,
glad you asked.
I think he's a little bit like David Lynch, that he dangles something in front of you and then whatever your interpretation of it is, that's fine, that's cool, that's okay. But I just enjoyed The Giant Brain and The Wanking Bogmen, I'll be honest with you, and I enjoyed the interplay between the politicians, and I quite enjoyed that it wasn't a savage, scabrous, Iannucci-ian satire, that it ultimately revealed these people as human. And that if they were politicians faced with what seems to be the end of the world, that they kind of refer to being normal people in a way. But they're also obsessed with bureaucracy still, and so they can't help but couch everything in politician speak, even right down to the end.
I feel like the end of the movie shows that they are politicians.
They are very much politicians.
Second.
But there is definite human connection to be made there. But that's for me not why I would recommend people go see this film. I would recommend that people go see this film because it is surreal and it made me laugh. And I say this all the time in the podcast. If a movie has something in it that I've never seen before, I give it props and I say, well done. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah,
so
that's fair.
It did.
This reminded me a little bit of Roy Anderson, but it's not as melancholic and sort of gentle as those satires. But I had a nice time. We gave it three.
Three, yeah.
I'm on board with that, I think.
I am as well. 3 stars then for Rumors, and that is not a rumor, that's a fact. That's the last time we could do that joke. So sad. Jimbo.
Hello.
Tell me about Night Bitch.
Night Bitch, indeed. So this is Marielle Heller's film, written and directed by Marielle Heller, and it is based on the book, as I think you said earlier, by Rachel Yoda, and it's not that Yoda. And it stars Amy Adams as the unnamed mother in this, and she's got a child who I want to say is about 3. Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah,
about
I thought about like two and a half, three.
And she's a stay-at-home mom. She was an artist. She's given up her work. Voluntarily, she's given up her work as an artist to focus on being a mother at home. Her husband, played by Scoot McNairy, is going off to work every day. And she is struggling. She goes to the library. She does little sing-along sessions. She loves her son. But it's a grind, as these things are. Her husband, who is, I think it's fair to say, well-meaning but oblivious to the kind of identity crisis and existential issues that she's going through, just sort of swans off each day and kind of leaves her to it, and then expects her to help him out even when he's looking after the kids. So there's the woman's labor aspect of this that I think she's finding really hard to deal with, and how she fits into the world, what her identity is and who she is post-baby and to a certain extent post-career at this point. Now, she's also turning into a dog. So
James, you've buried the lead.
I may have buried the lead in the garden.
Which is
with
good
a bone.
Because the dog doesn't like the lead. So.
Right, yeah.
Thank you. Jesus, I knocked it. I set them up and eventually you stumble over them.
Thank you. The novel, we should say, is a magical realist novel. And so the film kind of is in that vein. So yes, within the narrative of the film, she is 100% turning into a dog. And there are quite explicit scenes of body horror in this. There's a weird hairs growing on her. She's got growths on it, like a vestigial tail growing. And she does actually turn into a dog. But it is, you know, you have to watch it. And even though it's presented literally, it's a metaphor for what she's going through and her identity and how she's sort of wrestling with who she is. And initially, look, I don't love magical realism. It bothers me. Like, it's just, it's not as much as Rumors does, but it bothers me a little bit. Because
it's not
like,
June Part 2, yeah, Aliens
exactly.
or Die Hard, you're furious.
Exactly. I'm a man of nuance and I do not generally enjoy magical realism. That said, what I really enjoyed about this film was the central truth to it, which is something I don't think that, you know, always gets treated or covered well, which is that people understand, like, films that deal with postnatal depression, they deal with, you know, metaphors for postnatal depression. But what this tackles is not that, which feels more concrete and understood. It tackles what comes next. And, you know, regardless of whether, you know, postpartum depression comes into it, it's the sense of identity and where that goes, not when the child is born, but when the child is 2, when the child is 3, when, you know, they're a little person that needs attention all the time, but, you know, women are struggling with, like, they don't have a job to go to. Who am I? Am I interesting anymore? Am I plugged into things? Do I have anything to talk about? And she speaks to the other mothers and she can't quite relate to them because she's really struggling with her identity as a mother. But when she talks to her former colleagues, artists, she can't communicate with them either because she feels like she has nothing to contribute to them. And she's coming, frankly, undone because she doesn't understand where she fits into the world and who she is anymore. And I think there's a, you know, a real quandary there and a sort of a rage to it and a resentment. And she funnels it, understandably, to be fair, at her husband in this. And I think you really feel it. And I think the emotional heart of that rings true. And I thought that was done very, very well. I think the dog stuff, you could 100% excise from this film and it would lose nothing from it. I think as a drama of a kind of a woman on the edge dealing with a husband and children and trying to reassert herself into the world, I think that's an interesting story in and of its own right, fur and tail aside. So I'd have been perfectly happy with that. But I did, you know, I enjoyed it for that side of it. The dog part of it, less so.
Okay. Sounds interesting. Hell's Bells, obviously, yeah. This has got a great pedigree, chum.
Oh, boy.
It has been mooted for Oscars. Do you think it'll win a lot?
Oh, boy. Well, I hope so, because, you know, if the narrative was that Leonardo DiCaprio was due by the time he did The Revenant, you know, it was like, it's his time. I mean, how many times does Amy Adams have to turn in another
performance? Maybe she should just fucking sit in the puddle for 2 hours. It seemed to work for him.
Wow. Anyway, so maybe this is her version of sitting in a puddle for 2 hours. I don't know. But yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I think there's a lot of anger. There's so much anger in this film and it comes through so clearly. And I think Marielle Heller, there's some fascinating interviews with her. I read a really good one in, I think, The New Yorker, where she's talking about, like, this, you know, she had to stop working for a while to obviously have their kids and did find it incredibly frustrating and did find it tested her marriage and all this kind of stuff. And she's kind of channeled all of that into this film and you can feel the rage and the frustration. She also said that the film's a comedy for women and a horror for men, which I thought was an interesting way of thinking about it. I'm not sure it's a comedy for women either, but there are funny moments. There are definitely funny moments. Also really, really good both toddler acting, but obviously more importantly at that age, toddler direction. So the twins who play Sun.
Really good.
Fantastic. And I kind of assume that any time that he's not facing the camera and you hear his voice, it's been recorded separately and they've done some clever things. Because, you know, you can't direct three-year-olds. Like, that's just impossible. But at the same time, the way that they've clearly worked together, the relationship she's built up with the two boys, I think is just astonishing. They're wonderful. I say they because obviously at that age, twins are playing the role. It's not just one kid. It's Arlie and Emmett Snowden play the little boys. And that, they do a magnificent job. Absolutely magnificent.
Cool.
But yeah, I liked it. I think there were times where I was like, okay, I've got it now. Let's move forward. Mm-hmm. A little bit of that, you know. And I think that's probably one of the issues you're actually having with the dog stuff. Because I think if it is, whether it's fantasy or her reality or literally true, doesn't really matter. But I think it's a very slow build.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I needed it to be that slow.
Because it feels like it makes one point, but it makes it very, very well. But it is also a feature-length film. And you kind of need a little bit more to it. But there are great moments. There's a very, very pointed conversation between mother and husband, mm-hmm. as they are known in the film, where she lays out her grievances in no uncertain terms. And then he comes back with some very pointed sort of character critique, which also has a ring of truth about it. I think more specifically because it rings true with her as well. And it's all of her fears essentially laid bare. Mm. And it's an absolutely brutal exchange. Like, it's quite hard to watch at times, but it has an emotional honesty to it, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also think that the 3-star rating we gave it was fair.
Yeah.
All right. Indeed. We gave this one 3 stars. 3 stars then for Night Bitch, out in cinemas right now. But one last film to talk about very, very quickly this week is a film that kind of just snuck out on Disney Plus last week. I guess technically in time for the Christmas season. It is technically a Christmas film, although that is, I would say, more window dressing in this than it is in Die Hard Hell's Bells. It is David Gordon Green's Nutcrackers. And it's I'm fascinated by how this film has kind of been buried.
Mm.
David Gordon Green.
Yep.
No, he didn't have the best of starts to the year with the Exorcist movie, but still a very, very high profile major director, I would say. And this is Ben Stiller's first movie as a lead in some time. He's taken a lot of time away from the camera. He's been doing a lot of directing, Severance, etc., etc. And now he's back in this as a man who goes back to Ohio. He is a high-flying Chicago real estate type dude who goes back to Ohio because his sister and her husband have been killed in a car crash. And he is going back ostensibly to oversee to look after in the short term for his four tearaway nephews.
Yeah.
Now you can kind of guess how this film's going to unfold. Yeah. What really surprised me is how much it worked for me.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing about this. So he doesn't even want to look after them for any length of time. He, as far as he's concerned, he's going to sign some papers so they can be fostered out and the problem can be dealt with, essentially. And of course, that doesn't go quite to plan. Their social worker is played by Linda Cardellini. Is like, I'm sorry, you're going to have to stay for a few days and look after these kids. The boys, by the way, are played by four brothers, I believe. At least they've all got the same surname.
That's right. Mark Wahlberg.
No, they are Homer Jensen, Ulysses Jensen, and Arlo and Atlas.
They're all real life brothers.
All
very, very good.
And they're all really good. Yeah. They clearly, again, I think, you know, like we were saying with the directing toddlers in Night Bitch, I think, you know, it's a matter for a lot of young performers of making them feel safe, making them feel mm-hmm. like they can play, making them feel involved. And I think these kids clearly did. It's obviously scripted as well. This isn't something they've just improvised, but they really feel like they take ownership of those characters and, you know, kind of were allowed to do so and felt safe in doing so. So, the boys just seem really vivid and alive and 3D yep. and rounded. And therefore, you know, even if you do kind of feel like you see where this is going, it feels a bit more likely because of that, because they are so kind of,
yeah.
they have so much personality. And it's nice to see Ben Stiller kind of back in a lead. It feels like it has been an enormously long time.
It has been a long
really
time.
Really nice to see that.
I had a really, really good time with this. I was not expecting a lot. It was kind of just dumped on Disney Plus without very much warning or fanfare. And I was just a little bit, really? You can almost write this movie in your sleep. But it's about the tone and the mood and the execution. And for me, this really, really worked. This really got me in the feels for a number of reasons. The end really, really worked for me. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very moved by the end of the film, I have to say.
And there is some Christmassiness at the end.
There's a little bit of Christmassiness. I wouldn't say it's a comedy necessarily. It's funny. It's got some funny moments. But it's more a comedy drama. But the thing that really, really struck me about it was it seemed more of a return to, because, you know, David Gordon Green's a really interesting director. You can pin him down, you know, and after his initial indie darling phase, he then made a bunch of daft comedies. And then recently he's been making horror film reboots, the Halloween trilogy and the Exorcist trilogy. Well, it was meant to be a trilogy. And then obviously the first one died and it's ours. But he'd already moved on to this. Because he's restless. But this reminded me a lot of things like Prince Avalanche and reminded me of George Washington, and that it has a real authenticity to the performances and to the camera work and to the characters as well, which I really, really liked. It just felt like a very, very real movie. It felt like a very, very sweet movie. And the Ben Stiller character is interesting because he's not a terrible guy. So no. it's not the arc that you normally would expect from a movie like this, where he's a real Scrooge, he's a real Grinch, and he gets shown the error of his ways, and there's a moment where he really falls in love with the kids. He doesn't really want to look after them. Then there isn't a moment in the film where he has an epiphany and goes, oh my God, these kids are amazing. For the most of the movie, he's still trying to offload them onto other people. But they do wear him down, and in a very, very human way. I really, really, really liked it. I think, you know, I can see this one being something that people discover as the years go on. I really liked it. I don't think we have an official Empire review. I'd go 4. I don't know about you.
I'd easily be a 3, but yeah, I could probably see my way to a low 4, but probably a 3 for me.
All right. Okay. So 5 stars then for Nutcrackers. You doing it on Bah Humbug?
I was planning, I'm going to have to double bill it with something else because I've got hardly any episodes left to record. So.
Okay. And I'm on when?
That one.
Okay. Great. And James is on when?
He's not.
All right. Well, listen, on that note, that is it for this week's Emperor Podcast. You can tell I'm back because this is fucking hell. This is a long one. I need to edit it tonight. Oh, God, what have I done? Anyway, join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by Kenji Kamayama, Joseph Chow, and Jason DeMarco, who are the director and producers, respectively, of the new animated Lord of the Rings movie, The Lord of the Rings, The War of the Rohirrim. And that's going to be an extended excerpt from an Empire VIP Club event that Helen here hosted last night.
Yeah, I did.
And went...
really well.
Badly.
Oh.
I mean, sorry, really well. Sorry, went really, really well. Thanks. Good. Excellent stuff. And we'll also be joined by, very happy about this, returning to the podcast for the first time in too goddamn long, Jerry Butler, one of my favorite interviewees. He is back, and this time he's Santa Claus. He is Santa Claus in a charming animated film called The Night Before Christmas in Wonderland. So there you go. Does Jerry Butler say fuck in that movie and kick someone down a well? You'll have to find out by watching it. But there you go. But anyway, until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it's time to say goodbye to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning, one of whom has checked out already. But
sorry about that.
Yeah, but oh God, here he goes.
Goodbye, James.
Goodbye, Chris. Would you like to know who we've got on Pilot TV on Monday?
No.
No?
No, but please, just fucking get it over with.
Joe Barton, writer of Black Dove, starring Keira Knightley, joined us in this very studio. He was on the show for the whole show, and it was loads of fun.
Well, that's tricky because I like Joe.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was here.
God damn it.
And he was a barrel of laughs.
Anyone else?
No. Well, Boyd and Kay, unfortunately.
Oh, but, for God's sake. I like Joe. You know,
Boyd,
I like
Kay.
Boyd. I mean, there's a little bit of Liverpool Arsenal rivalry going on at the moment. You know,
well, Joe's a Tottenham fan, so.
Well, he wouldn't know anything about being at the top of the Premier League, then, would he?
Oh,
well, yeah, there we go. That's good. They've only won the league twice in their entire history, Tottenham Hotspur, and yet they consider themselves to be a big club. Anyway. Helen O'Hara, I don't know why I've opened up a fucking can of worms there, haven't I? Anyway, it's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo. Good Lord.
Good Lord. Good Lord. And it's goodbye from me. I am off to think of a funny thing to say at the beginning of this episode. First time for everything, right? Merry Christmas, you filthy animals. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.